Good morning. I'll call to order the House Interim Committee on Environment and Water. Welcome, committee. Thank you for being here promptly. I'm starting late, but folks, we're here. Glad to get underway for our second or third to last interim committee meeting of this legislature. We're going to begin. I think folks have the agenda. We're going to be on a pretty tight timeline, so I'll ask our presenters to keep their comments brief. We've allotted, although it's not on the agenda, we have let folks know that the time that we're planning to spend on each issue, and we are spending the first 15 minutes or so on the Umatilla project, another update on the work that is underway out there, and we'll begin by hearing from Barry Norris and J.R. Cook. I want to welcome a couple of Umatilla County Commissioners, Dennis Doherty, I know is here, and Larry Givens. Welcome. Thanks for making the trip to the Capitol, and look forward to hearing about the continued progress on the project with which this committee has been so engaged. So, gentlemen, Mr. Norris, you're going to start us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Barry Norris. I'm the Water Resources Department State Engineer. With me this morning is J.R. Cook, who's the Executive Director of the Umatilla Basin Water Commission, and we're going to give you a short update on the progress on the project on the Umatilla Basin for below-ground storage. Just to remind the members of the committee that we're talking about the Umatilla Basin, where there are existing four critical groundwater areas up in the north-central part of the state, and the project, close-up of these critical areas, and the project consists of taking water out of the during wintertime when it's available and putting into two alluvial aquifer systems that are located what we call the Columbia Improvement District Aquifer System and the Echo Meadows Aquifer System through a combination of existing infrastructure and modified and new infrastructure from the Columbia River and then some from the Umatilla Basin. Legislature approved last session $2.5 million to begin implementation of the project, backed with lottery fund bonds. That was approved and signed by the governor. We have an agreement in place and a scope of work. From our viewpoint, the project has progressed very, very well. We're pleased with the results of the developing the scope of work. The implementation has started. We have a system in place, and we're funding the project as we begin moving through the year. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to JR, who will give you some details on the project.
No, do that quick. Again, thank you, Chair Cannon, for having us here today. My name, for the record, is J.R. Cook with the Umatilla Basin Water Commission. A little bit about the project itself. As you know, we're working right now with a $2.5 million grant through 3369 and the potential for loan funding down the road. I'm going to give you also an overview of the commission that has formed, its jurisdiction, and its plan to ensure that this project is a long-term project, not just a pilot project that goes away or gets absorbed into an irrigation district or something smaller. And then I'll give you a couple of concluding remarks on what you can stand to see from us the next time we're in front of you. A little bit about our requirements and expectations as we see them. We're putting the emphasis on ourselves for create opportunities for critical groundwater rights holders, an emphasis on off-season storage within the CGAs, and the fact that we're designing this to achieve net environmental benefit, primarily in-stream flow benefit, but also water quality and aquifer restoration, and that we have plans to have both final design and a stage of construction completed by the end of this biennium. This is you've seen this map many times. This is the 1069 maps that were put together by IRC back prior to the 09 session. We've now created this scope of work to refine that plan. 83% of the scope of work, about $2.1 million, is to go to design and construction. And of that $2.1 million, $900,000 is going to go to an on-the-ground project to get us stage one implementation of this larger project down the road. The remaining funds is to legal work, agreements, land acquisition, et cetera. An update on stage one, as we're calling it stage one, The project itself is to design a 25,000 acre foot storage or aquifer storage project in the county line area, and of that, 6,000 acre feet is what we propose to either be implementable or delivering water by the end of this biennium. Implementable, I mean by if we don't make this pumping season, through the time that water is available in the Columbia, we'll be able to begin pumping in the fall of 2011. This is our primary storage area for the project. We have recovery and distribution options that are being identified right now. We're actually entering some pre-app conferences on that component today, actually. And this is really the catalyst to the rest of the projects to provide certainty to proposed water users. You saw that larger map. This is a more refined map of where we're focusing the project. We have already identified that lower, that southern blue line. That's the line we're going to be bringing in for the 6,000 acre foot project. And then the Deschutes Basin has their blue whale. That's our white whale. That's going to be the aquifer that we're hoping to get 25,000 acre foot of storage into in the future. A little bit more close up of that, the hatch lines that you see to the center of that map is the line extended into the recharge location. So you see there's not very much pipe or very much construction that needs to happen for this first stage of the project, which we're very excited about. What that would do is get us to Echo Meadows, which is the other recharge location that Barry spoke to a little bit earlier. That site, our objectives there are to identify our recharge rates, our quantity available for use, and our water quality. And the biggest thing we want to do here, it's two birds with one stone. We want to provide certainty to our landowners to be able to market this to them, which we're able to do right now, basically, and help us in environmental decision making with that net environmental benefit piece. This is a little bit harder map to see, but as you see up to the northwest, that's one of our primary recharge locations that we're going to be going after for this year's recharge season. The one to the south is also one of our areas that we've identified for engineered infiltration. That gives us a good cross-section of the ability of that aquifer, which is the blue line, everything within that blue line, to accept water. So at this point, we refined our scope to two recharge locations in the Echo Meadows area and one in County Line. Now on to the Umatilla Basin Water Commission with your vice chair so happily with us there. Basically, that's our commission that is formed to manage this project. We developed this commission due to the fact that even though we had a great funding source and we had a willing base of landowners and stakeholders, we wanted to develop a commission that was legally binding, that was legally operating, to manage this project, both the grant stage and ensure that we have a water development plan for the future. And so that's, again, getting that back to that certainty that both the landowners require, and I know that you want to see from us as we develop this project that we're spending this money wisely and that this project is going to be a success. The jurisdiction of the commission's contains within an IGA that was signed by the commission and accepted by the state in December of 2009. It's to manage stage one of the project, but also to develop a long-term project management plan to ensure that this project moves forward into the future. That is a really busy slide, and I apologize for that. That just goes to show the complexity at which this commission is working right now. Not only are they looking at conveyance and storage and the financial end, but they're also identifying water management needs and moving forward with those as part of this larger project. So the commission has a pretty large scope of which they're working under right now. The operation of the commission at this point is they manage themselves just like a normal commission. They have monthly meetings. They collaborate with all the stakeholders in the basin to ensure that we're not losing anybody in this process and that we're meeting the requirements of 3369 and we're developing a marketable project. So just a little bit about in general or in summary, the aquifer restoration project is making progress. We're getting to the point where we've identified and begun the process of securing our agreements with landowners to start delivering water into those two aquifers. The basin is prepared to ensure that the project's development through the grant, but that not just that we develop it through the grant, like I said, but we ensure long-term success. And You will see water on the ground with this grant. There was quite a few questions about that earlier on, but we're pretty impressed with how fast the project's moving forward and actually how quickly the landowners have become more or less fond of the project because of the opportunities it creates. And that really balances that last slide or the last bullet there, which is that it will be marketable to our users. And that was another question that we wanted to answer early on with this commission, is how can we make this marketable to the end users who are going to pay for it down the road. Some of the things that we're still working on to overcome is more or less some of the permitting issues. Again, this is a pretty unique project. We're bringing in new surface water supplies to replace basalt groundwater rights throughout a very, very large basin that encompasses two counties, an Indian reservation, and many cities and stakeholders. And so there's some things that we're working on to ensure that there's some flexibility with how we manage this water and that we can provide opportunities down the road. So, and that's my contact information because most of you probably have never met me before. So I look forward to working with you in the future and providing more updates.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cook. And, you know, I'm sure that this committee, and in particular Vice Chair Jensen and Representative Smith, did a lot of the work that resulted in 3369, along with many other folks in this room. And it is my hope that this committee will remain engaged, certainly through this interim, and I expect ones to follow, as this project, of course, will be many years in the making. But I think it's really important, and we may have members of the committee who get tired of hearing about the Umatilla Basin, but I think it's important to keep track of the work that we put in motion, but that you're and the commission are really implementing. So it's good to meet you. Glad that you're on board, and appreciate the presentation here. A quick question from me, and then see if other members have questions or comments as well. When you talked about water on the ground, are you referring to withdrawals, and when would those begin to take place? Are we talking about as soon as next summer?
Yes, Chair Cannon, our goal is actually to get the pipeline and the infiltration basins constructed within this biennium. Our hope is that we can have them constructed prior to the April 15th deadline, which is the deadline at which we can no longer pump water out of the Columbia River. If we can't meet that deadline, we'll have to begin pumping in the fall of 2011 when we can again pump under our permit.
Uh-huh. And when, I guess, so when, at what is the soonest point at which the aquifers would be, users would be withdrawing water from the aquifers?
The user side for withdrawing depends on the permits, and that's, again, what we're working on right now. It all depends on the monitoring requirements and all of the safeguards that they want put in place to ensure that we're tracking that water for the consumptive use side and that we're meeting the net environmental benefit side. So we're going to get water on the ground within the spring of this year or the fall of 2011. Or the spring or fall of 2011, I should say. But when the ability for the landowners to begin pumping that, or the commission to begin providing that water to those landowners, depends on those secondary permits that we're still negotiating with the OWRD, or beginning those negotiations.
Okay, thank you. Representative Booth.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Norris and Mr. J.R. Cook. Mm-hmm. This is good news, and I'm really happy to hear that you've come so far in such a small amount of time. And if you are at all interested, I think you fit the bill for a nomination for the Stockholm Water Prize. Deadline's the 30th to nominate, and the site is siwi.org, siwi.org. And there are several categories, but I think you should do it. I'm always trying to get Oregon in the mix there, and it's a great and prestigious prize. And your project fits the bill because it is transferable to pretty much any river system. And water is such a precious commodity anymore, and I think that, you know, this kind of work could really do a lot of good around the rest of the world, too. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Representative Benz. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be curious in knowing your lesson to be learned from this process and what you might suggest to others, in following up on Representative Boone's comment, that could save the most time in moving through the process. In other words, I'm interested also in when you're actually going, when we're actually going to see the hoped-for outcome. And I'm just curious where you could compress and what you see we could do differently that would allow us to speed the process up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vence, that's a great question. We've been learning basically as we go with this project. It's the only lesson that I could see that learned that would go to the speeding the process up is obviously the permitting side. The contractors, the farmers, everybody that is behind this project can construct these with private funds and with the private partnership that we're doing. But the permits are what you really need to have your, should I say, ducks in a row on, because these projects are so unique and you're working with so many different state agencies to get both the aquifer recharge piece done and the consumptive use side done. Because not only do you have to prove that you can get water into the ground, we also have to prove that you can track that water and ensure that you're meeting permit requirements on how you provide to those secondary uses, be it consumptive uses or non-consumptive fish type uses. So that would be the one lesson that we've learned, is to begin that permitting process well in advance.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen?
I don't thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any particular questions as such, other than, like I think the members of the committee here have all been, uneasy maybe about the time process. I think we probably didn't understand the complexity of putting the organization together, do appreciate very much the work that has transpired in this regard, and it does now seem like things are moving ahead, full speed ahead, and that's, at least for me, certainly good news. Just one quick question, and maybe this is for Barry, I don't know, but if you remember that piece in the East Oregonian a few weeks ago about the uniqueness, I think, of some of this land to be able to do that, would it be possible for you to expound on that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, if I understand your question, the uniqueness of the land in regards to as being receptive to this type of a project, is that what you're getting at? That's true. This was the perfect representative. This was the perfect location to have this project because of the uniqueness of the geology, the uniqueness of the existing infrastructure for moving water from place to place, and the uniqueness of the cooperation that exists out there among at all levels between the local governments, the farmers, the irrigators, and the cooperation between state government as well. But so that's true. It was a perfect place to put all this in place, and that's one of the reasons it's moved so quickly. The size of the project and the rate at which it's moved is truly unique for a project of this size. But what it does is it serves as a model now for the rest of the state, for the rest of the country, on how to organize a project. You've got to get all your pieces in place in the beginning. That's the communication links and the right people in place, and then move ahead with the assistance, some assistance from state government to get the thing started, a good feasibility study, and then get implementation started. So it's unique in that it was a good place to start, and that it's worked very well, but it serves as a very good model for the rest of the country, the rest of the state.
Thank you. And I think I wanted to point out to the committee something that I know probably they already know and understand, but this is not necessarily the same type of project that might be required in another basin someplace else. There's a certain environmental conditions that exist there that might not appear in other parts of the state. That doesn't mean that the process that has been gone through here would not apply to work or activity in another basin someplace else. So I wanted to make that distinction that we can't look to every basin and say we're going to do aquifer recharge in this way in another basin someplace. We have a very, very unique situation in the Umatilla Basin on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. And you want to make a comment quick?
Yeah, very, very quickly. It'd be very helpful to track financial value after we get water on the ground. So if there's going to be the case made for either for loan funds for this project or for other projects, it'd be very helpful to have that data. Second, if there's, you said sort of potential loan money, if there's that request going to be made, we should have a sense of what that's looking like relatively soon. And it'd be helpful to, and as much information as we have on timeline of, beating the April 15th deadline, or not, would be great.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
I appreciate you both for being here.
Mr.
Representative Jensen.
Is it possible, or would you be kind enough to email members of the committee your slideshow?
Oh, that's a great idea.
That would be super.
Email, so I gotta,
and if you email it to Beth, our committee administrator, we've got it.
Machine.
Super.
So,
so you'll send it out.
I will.
Thank you, Beth.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank
great.
You.
Thanks. We're going to move now to another part of House Bill 3369. It established the Integrated Water Resource Strategy, and a quick update on that process from the department, Phil and Brenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. For the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department, and with me here this morning is Brenda Bateman, who's, as you know, our chief ramrod for this little project we have underway. I would like to note, relative to your previous agenda item, how pleased the department is with the way the local community has stepped up and moved forward with this Umatilla project. The formation of the commission, I think, has been the major milestone in recent times, and we're just thrilled with the progress that's moving forward at this point. So, to the strategy, Mr. Chair and members. We're going to talk about just a couple quick things, because we know your time is short, but just a couple reminders on the background here. We wanted to spend a little time on who's been involved in this situation thus far, and then Brenda's going to talk about the open houses and workshops and some of the results that have come from those efforts thus far. You'll remember House Bill 3369 has directed us to implement a process to understand and meet Oregon's water needs, and directs our department to lead, the Water Resources Department, but we've had a very, I think, fruitful partnership with DEQ, ODF&W, and ODA. DEQ has really been a primary partner in this effort, and frankly, we wouldn't have been able to accomplish near of what we have done so far without those folks. And it's interesting that the bill has asked us to account for many different things as we develop the strategy. One of those is climate change, land use, population. So we're working on gathering all this information at this point in time. One of the things I've been really pleased with is the amount of participation we've had from the interested folks in this effort with us. We have an 18-member policy advisory group with all sorts of different entities represented on that group. Tribal government, the Umatilla tribe, is a member of that policy advisory group. Many, many other folks that have a key stake in the water resource are involved there. We've had a 15-member agency advisory group of state agencies that have been, I think Brenda would tell you, very much engaged in this process and a great help. So broader than just the four the bill named, 15 state agencies have been participating regularly in this process. And then recently, Brenda has pulled together a federal liaison group with 10 federal agencies now that are engaged in assisting in this process, and then numerous other partners. Again, I mentioned tribal governments have been very much involved. We've had all sorts of private firms and local governments engaged in the in this effort. And so I think that's a kind of an initial real positive for us in terms of the number of people who, without compensation, have been willing to step up and engage in this process. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it quickly over to Brenda for a couple more thoughts.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman, Senior Policy Coordinator for the Water Resources Department. And I wanted to thank all of you for your support and participation thus far in the strategy. I think many members of this committee, as well as your colleagues throughout the legislature, participated in many of our events this past spring and summer. That's where we've spent the bulk of our time. And in this past couple of months, we've held 12 open house events. 11 of them were face-to-face, and then our 12th open house was available online with all the same materials, questions, and ways for folks to participate. Through that, we received almost 80 survey responses. And then on top of that, we've held more than 30 stakeholder workshops. And in all of these events, we believe we've been able to reach more than 1,000 participants. The incoming information, as you might imagine, and many of you who were there with the flip charts know, this represented quite a bit of information coming in, landed in a very large document, which is now up on our project website, which you can reach through our homepage. More than 40 pages of input from folks in all of these events. And what we asked them very simply were three basic questions. First, what is your vision for water as you look out into the future? Secondly, what challenges do you specifically see facing your community related to water? And then third, and related, what solutions would you like this strategy to be looking at? How would you like to address those challenges? So I just wanted to give you a flavor of the kinds of responses we heard. Again, these are just a few bullet points out of a 40-page results document that we produced. But just to give you a flavor, when folks talked about their vision for water, we really heard responses in two categories. One was more a focus on the physical water resource, swimmable, drinkable, fishable, that sort of thing. But then on the other side, folks had a real vision for this process and this discussion, making sure it was balanced, making sure that basins were able to implement real decisions, making sure that there was science-based action, less talk and more action. So those were the kinds of things we heard when we asked the vision question. On the challenges or problem side, these were some of the answers that we received. You can see some of them track very closely with what's in the bill itself, and then others were a broader list of challenges and problems that folks have identified in their communities. A real mix of water quantity and water quality and ecosystem problems. And one thing that really struck us was the thoughtfulness with which folks offered these ideas, whether they were students or water professionals or the general public. Folks really understand some of the water challenges they face. And third, and I think this may be some of the most interesting results from our events, there were solutions that were then offered. And we grouped them into 16 different categories, as you see here. These are roughly ranked in priority. That is the number one topic that came up in the most venues. So all 12 open houses and all 30 stakeholder workshops, folks mentioned something about groundwater and a groundwater type of solution they would like to see for their community, whether it had to do with ASR or other groundwater solutions. Following immediately behind it in terms of the number of times we heard this in our venues, folks were interested in pursuing more strong policies and programs on water conservation and efficiency. Water quality and public health ranked very highly. And then right behind it in slots 4, 5, and 6, water storage, allocation, and water reuse issues as things that folks would really like to be focusing our investments and efforts on over the next several years. Of course, in all 16 of these categories, there are many more, there's much more detail to be filled in, and that's in the larger document. So next steps from here. This fall, we'll be taking this 40-page document to our policy advisory group. They have the tough job of helping us pare down and prioritizing those 16 categories of solutions and challenges that we saw earlier. They'll then begin crafting recommendations, and that's what's going to land in this 2012 strategy. Also this fall, you'll see a new set of issue papers that will be available for public comment. And then as we move into the new year, we have a progress report that's due to the Oregon legislature on what we've done so far and whether we think we can make our 2012 deadlines or not. And then we'll be starting to review those recommended actions as they're getting set down on paper and drafted. We plan to go back out to visit with communities or hear from communities on those recommended actions probably a year from now and into the fall of 2011. With that, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Great. Maybe one quick question or not. I would just make the comment to public, those who are in the audience, that we welcome and hope to get additional public comments. So this process is not over. As your last slides indicated, the opportunity for the public to be involved reviewing the proposals that you're developing is not over.
Correct.
Let's just begin. So encourage people to continue to participate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Very true. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are going to hear next about Senate Bill 737 and the legislative report that came out, I think, early in the summer. We'll start with Dick Peterson and Jennifer Weigel and bring up another panel in a few minutes. But if you could let us know where we stand. This is a bill passed in 2007, I believe, that it has a long tail, so we're continuing to see the impacts of that legislation.
Yes, Chair Canton and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality, and with me today is Jennifer Weigel. She's the manager of our water quality standards section with DEQ, and we're very pleased to be here this morning to talk to you about one aspect of what DEQ is working on as it relates to persistent pollutants, and that is, as Chair Cannon, you pointed out, Senate Bill 737, and we're very pleased to come and talk to you about that today. I'm going to start out a little bit by talking, you know, chemicals are an important aspect of our society. They always have been and will continue to be in some aspect moving forward. When we're talking about chemicals that are persistent and get out of their intended use and end up somewhere there's a problem, persistent pollutants are those that come from a wide variety of sources, but they linger in the environment and stay for a long time, and now we're starting to see documented impacts on human health, wildlife, and the aquatic environment. And as I said, these stick around for a long period of time. And studies now are showing that they're showing up in water, sediment, fish, birds, and humans. And that is true for Oregon as it is everywhere else. So when DEQ thinks of its mission in terms of protecting human health and the environment, looking at toxics and toxics reduction and where the impact is an important part of what we do. So we're committed to work on toxics reduction and help Oregonians reduce toxics in the environment. And the approach that we're taking is comprehensive, but it's also, in my view, thoughtful. It's collaborative, working with all stakeholders and within existing resources. This is something that I think we all need to work on for the not only the future of Oregonian, but the ability to operate within Oregon, considering the use of chemicals in a proper way. So I'm pleased to report that we're working on that as well. Broadly. Today, as you pointed out, we're going to talk a little bit about one aspect of it, which is Senate Bill 737. And just before I turn it over to Jennifer, I just want to say and appreciate the work of the municipal governments that have been working closely with us over the past several years on this aspect of persistent pollutant, looking at persistent pollutants. And we would not be here today reporting to you the way we are without their help. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer.
Chair Cannon and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jennifer Weigel, and I manage the Water Quality Standards and Assessment section at the Department of Environmental Quality. What I'm going to talk about here this morning is I'm just going to highlight quickly for you where we are with meeting the major requirements that were contained in the legislation that was indeed passed in 2007. You know, as you may recall, one of the main themes and interests in developing this legislation was in response to a growing concern about toxic pollutants in our environment. And that's where the focus of all this began. And so where we are and what the three major components of the Senate bill were. One was directing us to develop a list of priority persistent pollutants, given the tongue-twisting nature of that, we've shortened it to the P3 in terms of how we talk about it. We completed that in June of 2009. Another major component that DEQ is responsible for developing was a report to the legislature on those pollutants, sources, and opportunities for reduction. We completed that in June, and I'll spend a little bit more time focusing on that in my presentation. The third major component is not so much something that DEQ is required to do, but is something that is focused on the municipalities and their charge for implementing this program. Two things that are required of them, one being to figure out how much of these pollutants are coming out of their wastewater effluent, and then for those where those levels of pollutants are found to be above certain health-based levels, they have a responsibility to develop pollutant reduction plans by July 2011. And so just to summarize where we are in terms of our overall process, as I mentioned, the first major requirements were really incumbent upon DEQ to complete the priority persistent pollutant list, and then also the legislative report, which we completed in June earlier this year. In order for the municipalities to know whether or not they need to develop a plan, we did a rulemaking to set concentration levels of those pollutants that their effluent would be measured against. Effluent concentrations above those levels would then necessitate the need for them to develop a pollutant reduction plan. And that's really where we are right now, is that as far as DEQ goes, we are transitioning from completing these major components that we've been required to do to moving into a facilitative and technical assistance role to ensure that the municipalities have the information that they need to be able to develop the plans on time. And again, I'd like to emphasize really that a lot of this work has been very key, the work that we've done with the municipalities in order to make this happen. A lot of the time frames, we've worked very hard to make sure that we've met them, and we continue to work hard and collaborate closely with the municipalities to ensure that these last remaining deadlines contained in the legislation are met. So to move on a little bit more detail related to the legislative report, we finalized that report in June of 2010. The legislative report, as described in the legislation, was broad in nature. We had four requirements that were contained in the legislation in terms of what it was to contain. First was the list itself. And then the other three pieces were to talk about, what are the sources of these pollutants? You know, what else, what do we know about these pollutants? Where do they move? How do they go throughout the environment? And what are the measures by which we would identify that present opportunities to reduce these? The other major piece that we had was that this report was to be developed based on existing data. So I'll go over these components in this slightly more detail here. Just as a refresher, the list that we developed, it identifies pollutants that are toxic and either persist or bioaccumulate in surface, have the potential to have those properties in the surface waters of our state. So the kinds of things that ended up on our list kind of really span, the whole gamut of different types of chemicals that you might think about. Personal care products, industrial byproducts, flame retardants, legacy contaminants, things that continue to be globally sourced and deposited on the land and then run off into the water, pesticides, both urban and agricultural types of pesticides, and a number of other chemicals that met the definitions that we established for that. And so as a result, we had this list that's quite broad in nature, and as a result, there's a large variety of sources from which these pollutants could be coming from. We have things, but I would say a common theme amongst all of these is that a lot of these can be traced back to kind of everyday activities that we all encounter in our day-to-day lives. You know, things that we use in our houses, that our households that become washed down the drain, things that become deposited on the landscape or have been left on the landscape based on past practices that then erode and run off into our surface waters. Combustion activities, those things also cycle through the environment. They combust, they start in the air, then they're deposited onto land and water, and they end up in our surface waters. And also things that continue that may not be originating here in Oregon, but arrive here through other means. So we highlighted these and documented what we knew about the potential for these sources for all of the 118 pollutants that were on our priority persistent pollutant list. We also used existing data to describe what we knew about each of the pollutants. What are their potential uses? What do we think they're being used for? Where might they be coming from? How much are getting into our waters? And if we didn't know how much were coming into our waters, if that data were not available, we tried to find surrogate measures. You know, how much is actually present in Oregon? How much might be being used in Oregon that we might be able to infer, at least on a relative sense, how much is in an environment that we have a responsibility to control? And whether or not there were data that were either Oregon-specific that we could identify and say, you know, here's what we know about how much of these pollutants are in our surface waters in the state, or what might we be able to infer from other data that we're aware of, and highlighted all of that in this report. And then we talked about what the opportunities were to reduce these pollutants. Now, we grouped these types of activities into two major categories, one being pollution prevention, getting at these pollutants before they even enter the surface waters of our state. This was the focus of the legislation, and then we put a heavier emphasis on this in the report that we developed. We also identified pollutant control and management, different types of activities that could still be used to control the release of these pollutants through things like treatment, how we store and dispose of these pollutants and cleanup. And this, I would say, you know, it tends to be probably more the focus of a lot of the programs that we operate today. But one thing that I think that we have found is, you know, really important about this the mandates of this legislation is that it really does have a focus on pollution prevention, which we think is the most cost-effective way to reduce these pollutants getting into the environment in the first place. So to that end, what we ended up doing was this nice little matrix, because we had 118 pollutants, and the legislation specifically asked us to prioritize activities for reduction. And so with 118 pollutants and a wide diversity of sources that they're coming from and some gaps in what we know, what we ended up doing was to kind of group pollutants that were similar in nature and then highlight among those groups of pollutants on a matrix, which ones of these do we think have the highest potential to cause harm and also have the most opportunities to reduce at the source. And so using the idea that pollution prevention is by and large the most cost-effective way in which we can reduce these, and coupling that with what we knew about the chemicals' properties in terms of their potential to cause harm to either humans or aquatic life, that's how we kind of teased out amongst all of this data that we compiled what we thought some likely candidates were in terms of pollutants that if we had to make choices and prioritize actions, lining up those pollutants with likely activities that we thought were ripe for kind of the best bang for the buck, so to speak. And so, and just talk a little bit about how we think the report might be used. As I mentioned, the report itself was very broad in nature. It highlighted all different kinds of sources. And so we think the opportunities for this report probably spans beyond just DEQ's own use. We think there's probably information in there that could jumpstart and provide some baseline information that different nonprofits or different entities might pick up on being able to start using public education. We think that some of the information in here will help the municipalities in their efforts to develop their reduction plans that are due next summer. And we also view that this has some great utility for us as we look at our different toxics programs across the agency, including the strategy that the agency is working on now. And so as I mentioned, that report that I just highlighted, we finished in June of this year, and so really where our focus is right now is working closely with the municipalities on the development of their reduction plans. The municipalities will be actually this week receiving the results of the first rounds of screening their effluent for these pollutants. So we are in the midst of both finding out what's there and then moving on to work together and look at what these plans ultimately need to look like so that they can be complete by July of 2011. And so with that, I will pause and ask if there are any other questions.
Great. Thank you for the update. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is hugely interesting. I just wanted to compliment the department for its efforts up in the city of Halfway in a situation where the cost of our rules and regulations have squarely impacted a town that doesn't have the ability to pay. And I think the department's done a wonderful job in managing that difficult situation. I'm just looking at the what I think is the administrative rule, which is 340-045-0100, and it appears to me that it imposes an obligation upon cities that have 1 million gallons per day or more to do certain reporting. Do we have any idea of the cost that this is going to impose upon these cities, what it's going to take for them to pay to respond to what we're doing?
And I'll point out that we are going to hear from the League of Cities next, so they may have some sense of that. You're welcome to give it a shot.
Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, what I can tell you about the cost for these cities, the laboratory analyses that we'll be seeing, that we're using to analyze the city's effluent is being conducted by DEQ's laboratory. So the cost for that is as we estimated, cost was not to exceed $7,000 per event, and there's two events. So per city, the cost is not to we expect not to exceed $14,000. Our preliminary feedback we're getting from our lab is less than that per city. In terms of in terms of developing the plan itself and the costs that cities might incur, at this point I can't I don't have a good figure for you since we are still getting the results back and we don't know how encompassing those plans will be or how narrow they might be.
Quickly, Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz, what I would say is the design around the pollution reduction planning with the communities was rather than looking at this as a standard development approach, just like developing a standard and municipalities that have to put treatment on necessarily, it's allowing municipalities to see what's there, look up the pipe, see within their own jurisdiction where they can look at how to reduce what's coming in as opposed to a what I would say a hardwired regulatory process where DEQ would say, okay, you have to build this mega $1 million treatment process for these facilities. So Jennifer's right. We don't know the exact cost. Municipalities could probably lead to that, tell that, but the idea is to not burden with costs that are unnecessary when there's a different approach.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, let's hear next. Thank you both for the presentation. And let's hear next from Mark Landauer and Daniel Eisenbeis representing the Special Districts and League of Cities, respectively. And while they're on their way up, and Daniel, I have to tell us why you're coming up in crutches. But while they're coming up, I do want to note that this legislation really did place the onus on municipalities, special districts, to not only fund the program, I believe, that DEQ has been administering to identify the persistent pollutants, but then to develop the plans and potentially implement some solutions. And I think it should be said that the source of these pollutants is not just cities and not just municipal systems. You were probably an easy target for legislators when it came to saying who's gonna fund this and who's gonna pay for it and who's gonna do the cleanup. And so I want to express my gratitude to your members for their participation in this program and for engaging in constructive solutions. It's certainly not my expectation that you would be able to clean this all up on your own, either from a cost standpoint or just from a practical standpoint, because some of these pollutants that have been identified are not ones over which there's going to be a whole lot that municipalities can do. But I appreciate that we're taking some steps in the right direction and look forward to hearing your thoughts on those steps now.
Good morning, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. Mark Landauer, representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. First, I'd like to express our gratitude to DEQ, Jennifer, Mr. Peterson, so forth. This has been a long process up to now, and going through up to the point where we are now has been a rather large undertaking, and now we're finally, as Jennifer mentioned, beginning to see the results of this process in that we are now finally getting the results of the first dry weather sampling of our effluent. We will be conducting a wet weather sampling beginning in November to get a second glance at what is appearing in our effluent. And so we're excited to see what is coming out, so to speak. Toxics reduction is an important issue for our members, and we certainly support the efforts that have been undertaken thus far. I'd like to remind the committee that publicly owned treatment works are the recipients of the material that is ultimately reaching our treatment facilities. We are not adding or putting this material that ultimately gets to us. So we do not produce these chemicals, nor are we responsible for putting them in our system. We are instrumental in treating that water to the best of our abilities, and oftentimes technology doesn't exist or is extraordinarily expensive to treat for some of the chemicals that have been identified on the P3 list. Providers, I'd also like to point out to the committee that treatment providers have a limited ability to change consumer behavior. Consumers base their habits on a multitude of factors, including familiarity, price, so on and so forth. So, for example, some folks use detergents, and some of the fragrances that are placed in detergents happen to be on the P3 list. How are we, as municipal providers, municipal treatment providers, going to reduce these? Well, ultimately, it's going to be about prevention. It's going to be changing consumer behavior. And we're going to have to educate consumers about what they're putting down the drain in the hopes that they'll change their behaviors. As noted under the report that talks about reducing persistent pollutants, there are many methods to reduce these, and many of those methods simply fall far beyond the ability of a municipal treatment provider. For example, chemical replacement through green chemistry research, market-based pollution prevention actions like product labeling and environmental certification, incentives for more efficient cars. Some of the chemicals that actually show up on the P3 list are due to combustion. As a result, how is a municipal wastewater provider going to influence the combustion or the products of combustion? Simply, that's not within our scope authority. We are, however, in a position to educate the public about various products that contain these chemicals and work with our citizens to find alternatives, thereby reducing the prevalence of those entering our systems. We'll be using the sampling results to focus our efforts on outreach and education, and look forward to partnering with other members of the community and building on our existing public education and outreach efforts to reduce the incidence of these chemicals in our systems. We will also continue to work with DEQ and support their efforts to reduce the P3 chemicals in Oregon's surface and groundwaters. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thanks. Let's hear from Dan.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis with the League of Oregon Cities. Our members include 242 cities around the state who constitute a majority of the treatment plant operators that are required to conduct sampling and develop plans under Senate Bill 737. I won't reiterate everything that Mr. Landauer said, but we certainly agree with many of the points that he raised. And we would like to express our gratitude to DEQ for really conducting a good faith partnership with municipalities throughout this process. The legislation is really groundbreaking legislation, and in in some areas is ambiguous, shall we say, and so it's been quite a process over the last few years of moving forward and both developing the list, the plan at DEQ, and now turning to the sampling and development of plans at the municipal level. Municipalities obviously are focused on the effluent sampling and analysis that is occurring right now, that occurred over the summer and will be occurring this fall. And then plan development. In regards to Representative Bence's question earlier about costs, obviously the cost of sampling is significant. Over the course of 2 years, individual municipalities also paid a surcharge to help support staff positions at DEQ to put together the list. Many municipalities have chosen to partner through the Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies to develop a sort of template for possible municipal plans, but it's important to keep in mind that the original statutory framework is really intended to be flexible so that we can have community-based efforts that are tailored to meet the needs, priorities, and capacity of local municipalities. We have quite a few question marks right now in terms of what may exceed the plan initiation levels that have been set by the state, but I certainly would not be surprised if the cost of plan development and implementation over the next several years runs from five figures to six figures, depending on the community. So the costs are quite significant. I'd like to compliment DEQ on their legislative report and the work that they put into improving the draft report that was released. It goes a long way in terms of compiling information, showing all of us in the state what we know about these compounds and also what we don't know. There's quite a bit that we don't know. Our hope is that moving forward, municipalities can do good work at the community level, that the framework of Senate Bill 737 is honored moving forward, and that hopefully some of the local work can be informative for other efforts. At some point, there's certainly questions that are raised about the efficacy of focusing on facility-by-facility efforts versus broader efforts, but we anticipate those are discussions that will occur down the road. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Great, thank you. Does either of your associations plan to present legislation to the 2011 legislature on Senate Bill 737 and your obligations?
At this point, the League does not anticipate introducing legislation.
Nor does the Special District Association.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thanks very much. And again, my appreciation for the work that and cost that your members are bearing to do this important job. So, thank you.
Thank you.
We will turn now. So I think we'll get on to oceans, but we've done waters. And we will move next to truck efficiency and idling. And so, Mr. Peterson, come on back up and bring Andy and Kevin with you, if you so wish.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. With me here today is Andy Ginsberg, who is the administrator of our air quality program for DEQ, and Kevin Downing, our diesel program coordinator. So we're here to talk to you about work that we were asked to do by the legislature last session on truck efficiency and idling. And in the way of introducing this, I just wanted to talk about climate change a little bit. It certainly is a pressing and serious issue, not only for Oregon, but the nation and the globe. And whether it's the outcome is decreased snowpack, reduced spring runoff, altered precipitation patterns, more severe forest or rangeland fires, or other types of outcome, the impact can and will be serious. on Oregon's environment, economy, and its people. If you remember the serious flooding that occurred in Vernonia, whether that was a climate change-related activity, those are the kinds of things that I think all of us are concerned about and the response and preparation that's needed as we think about the impacts of climate change moving forward. On this slide, I'm not going to get into it, but the 2007 legislative session, legislature set goals that Oregon is to aspire to in reducing its own greenhouse gas emissions, to look at our own ability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and think about climate change broadly. And DEQ is one of several agencies charged with making progress towards these goals. Fortunately, and I think this is one of the charges that you gave to us, is that many of the measures that reduce greenhouse gas emissions can also save energy and money and have the potential to bring not only reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but economic development to Oregon. And so these are the kind of measures that we're really looking at. And one thing that the legislature asked us, and you specifically asked us when we looked at things like truck efficiency or other things related to climate, is that we have an open and transparent process, that everybody knows what we're working on, and everybody that's involved has an opportunity to participate. And with that, on this particular aspect, we certainly involved and had rich discussion with stakeholders in their involvement and take all of comments serious and incorporate them in our reports and communication to you. I think the most important message that we got from the legislature is to have a great sensitivity to the economy of the state and our own budget and our ability to do business and work in Oregon, and really look at those ways, like I said before, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in a way that does save money and maybe even helps improve and or even give people an opportunity to make money and doesn't cause unintended consequences for people in terms of driving them out of business or that sort of thing. And we're taking that extremely seriously when we look at all of these. And the other thing that is sort of inherent in all of that is we do, under your direction, and just do generally rely on the best available science and really coordinate closely with EPA and neighboring states to ensure whatever we do is cohesive and sensible and considers what's going on adjacent to us and across this country and with not only within but with outside of our borders. So today, Andy and Kevin are going to give you a quick overview of what's going on with truck efficiency and idling, and certainly you're going to have an opportunity this coming session to decide what you might do with this report in terms of adopting recommendations that will be coming to you. So with that, Andy, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Cannon, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator, DEQ. And as Dick mentioned, we're here today to focus on truck efficiencies, but I just wanted to give you the briefest of overviews of the other greenhouse gas activities that we're pursuing. We don't have time to discuss those in any kind of detail today, but the chair has requested that we provide a more thorough briefing in February when hopefully you'll have some more time. As Dick mentioned, the major focus, our major focus has been to have an open and transparent process. We've had three major advisory committees with all views represented to design these programs. We've developed an outstanding website with opportunities for people to log, sign up and track any topic. We put together a number of white papers on the policy and technical issues that decisions will be required. We're conducting an extensive economic analysis that's funded by a grant we got from EPA, the federal government, using expert consultants. And we've held a number of public workshops. We intend to hold a number of additional workshops in addition to the formal public hearing and rulemaking process. And we've also made a great effort to educate our Environmental Quality Commission with a number of informational briefings on climate. And if I could brag for just a second, I'd just like to mention how proud I am of the extremely high-quality staff work that DEQ staff have done on this work. I think if you talk to any of the stakeholders that have been involved in these advisory committees, whether or not they support these measures, they'll tell you that DEQ staff did quality work and worked in an open and responsive fashion.
So this slide illustrates the activities we have going on. I'll just mention that upper left-hand corner, we're working on developing a low-carbon fuel standard that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuels. It was authorized by House Bill 2186 in 2009. We'll have a report for you by the end of the year on where we stand with that project. We also in the upper left-hand corner, we've got our low-emission vehicle standards that we adopted in 2006. This was a great success story. The efforts of Oregon and 14 other states ultimately led to a federal rule, and now we've got national regulations that were inspired by Oregon's efforts. Moving over to the right, you'll see greenhouse gas permitting. This is a new requirement from the federal government. Some of the largest greenhouse gas sources will require permits to construct and operate beginning in January 2011, and we'll be required to implement that program. And we're working on that now, and we'll have a legislative concept for your consideration during the session. And then moving down to the bottom left corner on greenhouse gas reporting, that's an effort to improve our understanding of the science of greenhouse gases. And we have a rule requiring reporting. We're working now on a rule to implement Senate Bill 38, adopted last session, that would expand greenhouse gas reporting. And Senate Bill 38 also directed us to evaluate funding for the program, so we'll have a report for you on that along with the legislative concept for your consideration. And then finally, truck efficiency and idling, which is the focus of today's presentation. So truck efficiency and idling is intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while also saving fuel and thus saving money at the same time. There's two approaches we're using. One is looking at the efficiency of long-haul trucks, and the other is reducing unnecessary idling from commercial vehicles. House Bill 2186 directed us to design a program and recommend legislation to you for your consideration. And I want to emphasize that DEQ does not currently have the authority to adopt this program. It would require new legislation. A copy of our executive summary should be in your materials, and the committee administrator should have our full report. And we developed this report in consultation with a broad group of stakeholders you can see on this slide. And I want to also emphasize that the report is DEQ's recommendation. We seriously considered the input from the stakeholders in this work group, but this is not a consensus report, and we're not speaking for the stakeholders, but we did utilize their input in developing this report. All the meetings were open to the public. We had a website with over 1,100 individuals subscribed to it. And because this program would save fuel, it does pay for itself within a few years, and it actually saves truckers money. But the challenge for truckers is obtaining the upfront capital to retrofit trucks and then to implement a program like this given the recession. So a lot of our study focused on these questions. And House Bill 2186 in particular directed us to look at the cost recovery through fuel savings, the availability of financing programs, a phased implementation, hardship exemptions, and the compatibility of a program like this with other states and with EPA. So I'd now like to introduce Kevin, who will walk you briefly through our findings.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Cannon and committee members. My name is Kevin Downing. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And while the focus here is really on greenhouse gases, the emissions reductions that we expect to get will also have benefits for also other respirable air pollutants, including air toxics that come out of any kind of combustion process as well. So, but for greenhouse gases, their levels are directly tied, particularly in the case of petroleum use, to fuel consumption. And as many reports have already noted, energy efficiency itself is a vast and low-cost energy resource in the United States and actually represents a very cost-effective strategy to mitigate greenhouse gases. And in particular, for medium and heavy-duty trucks, the findings we have in the report is that they consume a significant and increasing amount of fuel. In 2008, 26% of all the liquid transportation fuel was consumed in a medium or heavy-duty truck. Since 1990, greenhouse gases from trucking has increased by 70% as compared to all light-duty vehicles, which increased by 14% over that period of time. This even accounts for the change in the light-duty market going from sedans to pickups and SUVs. The Energy Information Administration projects that fuel consumption from trucks will increase in both absolute and percentage share terms over the next 25 years. And while barge and rail movement are more efficient than trucking and freight movement, they're all critical parts of the freight movement chain. Trucks are ubiquitous in every part of freight movements, and they represent an important part of the economy, and their usage itself is closely tied to industrial production. And as a result, trucks end up moving the majority of high-value freight. And despite the fact that rail and barge carriers move very large quantities of bulk commodities like coal and grains very efficiently, trucks also end up moving a majority of the freight tonnage in this country as well. And this reflects their key role in making just-in-time business model work, where costs have shifted from maintaining inventory to movement of parts and goods. As they say in the trucking industry, if you have it, a truck brought it. What we've identified is actually, and focusing within the truck realm, which covers a range of truck sizes from the large so-called Class 8s over-the-road trucks down to Class 3 intra-city delivery vehicles. It's really the long-haul trucks in particular that count for a large portion of the fuel consumed within this sector. That although they represent about 40% of the fleet of the trucks, they consume nearly 80% of the fuel consumed by heavy-duty vehicles. And to sort of highlight that again as well, what the opportunities are here in terms of improving the efficiency of these vehicles, in 2007, Congress directed the National Academy of Sciences to develop a report evaluating medium and heavy-duty truck efficiency opportunities and technologies. They looked at a number of strategies, many of which can be implemented on a new vehicle basis, including improving the engine's efficiency, weight reduction, transmission and driveline improvements, accessory electrification, waste heat recovery, hybridization and dieselization, but they also looked at other strategies that could be implemented on existing vehicles, like improving trailer aerodynamics, cab aerodynamics, tires, and weight reduction, rolling resistance for tires and wheels. They found that the tractor-trailer combinations have relatively high fuel consumption, very high average vehicle miles traveled, and a large share of the overall truck market. And in fact, they concluded, I quote, "A given percentage reduction in this vehicle category will save more fuel than a matching percentage improvement in any other vehicle category. The potential fuel savings in tractor-trailer trucks represents about half of the total possible fuel savings in all categories of medium and heavy-duty vehicles." So one of the next charges that we were presented in House Bill 2186 was looking at return on investment or simple payback as well in terms of investing in typical technologies that could be deployed to improve the efficiency of over-the-road trucks. Let me spend a few minutes on this chart because it can be a little bit confusing. We looked at various scenarios in terms of differences in the price of fuel, much less how many miles a year a truck will travel. We also did analyses based on a single tractor and trailer, but for the most part, there are more trailers than tractors, than trucks, because many trailers are parked at a warehouse where they're loaded or unloaded while the tractor itself goes back into service, continuing to make money for the company. So we ran this scenario with an average of three trailers per tractor with improvements to each of the trailers plus the tractor in order to make this work. This particular graph displays the annual net return based on assuming a four-year note to pay for the cost of this upgrade at a 10% annual interest rate. And you can see that for many of these over-the-road trucks that travel upwards of 100,000 miles a year, that there's a net positive return even after accounting for the loan costs, at fuel prices at $2.50 a gallon. Currently, I checked yesterday, diesel fuel in Oregon is running at about $2.90 a gallon. It's up 33 cents a gallon from this time a year ago. Some of the committee members suggested that I shouldn't have stopped at $3.50. I should have gone up to $4 a gallon, but it's pretty clear that the net return is positive. And even down at levels where, for instance, at about 50,000 miles or so, there's still generally a positive return on investment over considering the cost of the note. On the simple payback analysis, which simply considers not the cost of money, but simply the return on the investment itself, we showed that at a truck traveling at 95,000 miles a year, that the simple payback is actually less than 2 years' time. So what we're recommending is an adoption of a program that's virtually identical to that's now in place in California, an attempt to harmonize our efforts with what's going on there, as well as to extend that which would be to focus on the sector within the trucking industry that uses the most fuel, that is heavy-duty over-the-road trucks, and even then, only those pulling 53-foot box vans or refrigerated trailers. We would look at having this begin with the model year 2016 model year. This is for newer tractors and trailers, but also would begin phasing in for existing equipment within shortly thereafter. California's program, by the way, began with this year's model year 2011 tractors and trailers. And what we're looking at, and you'll see more details in the report, but basically we're building on EPA's SmartWay Technology Program, which is an organized effort to specify and certify current and emerging technologies to create efficient tractor and trailer combinations. We're looking at potentially requirements that would look at improving the rolling resistance of tires as well as reducing the aerodynamic drag of vehicles. This would only apply to those vehicles that operate at a sufficient level of service where there's actually a net return where we can see the actual benefit. So trucks that travel less than 50,000 miles a year or travel less than 100 miles or within a 100-mile radius of their point of dispatch or trucks used in port service like in drayage service, those would all be exempt. We're also recommending, in consideration of some of the current economic circumstances, that there be a financial hardship exemption so that if you cannot get financing for this kind of work, that you would receive an annual deferral from compliance. And we'd also, because we're looking to harmonize with the California effort as well, any truck that is in compliance with the California program, which has already begun and in place, would also be compliant with any Oregon effort as well. We're looking to, given the state of the economy, which I guess is the sort of the topic number one or number subtext in a lot of conversations these days, is that we're looking at a phasing in this program over a period of time that would actually be able to accommodate the expected improvement in economic conditions, making it easier for financing and truckers to actually be able to make these kinds of investments. So we're looking at, again, on this schedule, so for a large fleet beginning in 2016 over 2021, and for smaller fleets, those with less than 20 trailers, they would have until 2022 with a later start time as well. This would, again, would mirror and harmonize with the work that's going on in California. We were also tasked with looking at a recommendation for an idling law. We wanted to offer recommendations on reducing commercial vehicle idling. Idling can be a significant source of fuel use, operator costs, as well as emissions, much less contributing to nuisance conditions locally. Idling can be broken down into long duration and actually workday idling. Long duration idling is typically done by long haul drivers who are operating in a federally mandated rest period, and they don't make enough to actually go into get a hotel motel room every night, so they stay within their cab or their truck, and they run their truck engine to maintain simple housekeeping services like maintaining heat or air conditioning or powering appliances and whatnot. But it's a fairly inefficient use of the engine in that application. There's also workday idling, which is the kind of the normal idling that occurs in the normal workday trucks. There's national estimates that overnight idling might consume 670 million gallons a year at a cost, including maintenance, over $1.8 billion. Workday idling, given the volume of vehicles that are out there, might consume something like 1.9 billion gallons of fuel at a cost of $5.4 billion a year. We don't have estimates in Oregon per se, but actually generally our fuel consumption rate in Oregon for diesel is about 1.5%, so we'd expect that those would be the range of the impacts here in Oregon as well. There are, at this point, about 27 states, much less a variety of local jurisdictions that have idling requirements on the books now as it is. With varying requirements and conditions and exemptions, what EPA did several years ago was convene a consensus group that developed a model state idling law. And that's the effort that we're recommending that we adopt here in Oregon as well, in an attempt to build compliance, to improve compliance by harmonizing the requirements across jurisdictions. We're recommending that it would apply to highway commercial trucks and buses, would limit idling to 5 minutes in a 60-minute period, 30 minutes for loading and unloading situations, but also provide exemptions for specific circumstances like to if the highway conditions required it, to prevent a safety or health emergency, if it were to power auxiliary equipment on the vehicles like hydraulics or battery services, or vehicle inspections or other mechanical difficulties would also be required an exemption. We're also recommending as well that this program be phased in. The department would commit to an education outreach program to ensure that people are aware of this effort as well, and that then they can accommodate investments if needed be to their vehicles with currently available technologies that could apply auxiliary power much more efficiently than running the truck engine, much less battery packs, engine stop-start systems, or other technologies that are currently available to make this happen. In summary, I guess I'd like to we have worked really hard to acknowledge the differences in duty cycle, that not all trucks work all the same, and that the recommendations are focused on that part of the duty cycles that really have the greatest impact on reducing fuel consumption. We'd also like to point out, too, that what we're offering here is a recommendation where partners, where the trucking community has sufficient notice to plan, and also that they have options to act, that this will harmonize with comparable requirements elsewhere, minimizes financial hardship, and also secure the environmental benefit. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Kevin. Let's see if there are questions. I suspect there may be. Representative Thompson.
How do you anticipate the idling law will affect heavy-duty stop-start vehicles like garbage trucks?
Go ahead, Kevin.
Representative Thompson and Representative Chair Cannon, sorry, that's straight. Actually, we don't expect that there will be an impact on garbage trucks, because actually when they're working, they're actually operating power takeoff equipment on the vehicle itself, and so that would be an exemption from the idling restriction.
Okay. Representative Boone?
Yeah, I just wondered if you'd done any figuring on airplanes when they taxi out and taxi, you know, once. Has anybody thought of having them towed out and then take off and land and then towed in, instead of all that time spent? And I know they have to idle when they're on the tarmac if they're waiting in line to go, but to get out there, does that fit into it?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, I know that's something that we'd have to look at. What I have been aware of is actually efforts while they're parked at the gate. Many times, as I understand, they will use their engines to provide power on board the engine, and so providing, I think that actually electrifying the gates for the plane so they can reduce their engine use at that point might be an opportunity, but I haven't heard of the taxiing component.
Any other questions? I'm wondering, and we'll hear, of course, when we get legislation, we'll hear from various interest groups. I'm wondering if you, given what you've said about the return on investment for these truck efficiency upgrades, why, if you can speak to why trucking companies aren't rushing to do this, haven't rushed to do this already, and how your proposed legislation acknowledges the challenges that the trucking industry faces in attempting to implement these solutions.
Chair Cannon, there are a number of barriers for trucking companies. You probably won't hear from them directly, but financing is a significant challenge. And as you heard Kevin say, we would provide deferrals if trucking companies are unable to get financing. But any kind of financing would compete with their other capital needs. And in addition, there are just a number of other things that are on truckers' priority list. So that this is something, even though it does save money, it's something that requires an initial investment, competes with time that they may spend in management of their operations. And so we have seen a lot of interest in the trucking industry in fuel savings, and I'm sure they will talk to you about that because it's an important part of their business. But in terms of this program, it seems that having a regulatory requirement that has levels the playing field and has an adequate phase in time is going to be necessary if we want to see a large-scale adoption of this type of technology.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate that, and appreciate the fact that your proposal builds in these exemptions, deferrals, phase-in period related to the kind of challenges, particularly on the financing side, that trucking companies may have. It strikes me, at least on first blush, as a pretty nuanced and targeted way of trying to deal with the challenge that we presented to you in 2186. So I appreciate that. Are there any other questions, comments? Great. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
So we are heading towards marine reserves and other ocean policy for our final three topics, and we'll start with Ed Bowles and Anna Pakenham. Welcome. I think we've allotted about half an hour to get an update on marine reserves. So if you need the time, use it. If not, we'll be happy to get ahead of schedule.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have with me Anna Pakenham. She's one of the agency team members on the marine reserve process, and she'll be providing the presentation. Mr. Chair, we'll take your message to heart and move right through this. We did have a chance to update you last November, and this is on the progress implementing House Bill 3013. So we'll move through and hopefully have some time for questions at the end. So, Anna, go ahead.
Chair Cannon and committee, thank you so much for this opportunity. So just briefly, what I'm going to go over today is a background on the process. I know you guys have been updated recently, but just in case you forgot. Then I'll briefly go over the three different types of sites that we have in the marine reserves process. We have a proposal site, pilot sites, and evaluation sites, and those are on kind of all different phases. And then briefly go over what we're anticipating into the future. So very quickly, the marine reserves process has been going on in Oregon for a long time, with various levels of controversy. And in early 2008, the governor issued Executive Order 0807 and sent a letter to OPAC, the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, to kind of set some sideboards on how Oregon would move forward in the marine reserves process. So there would be a public nomination process with the sideboard you see here, that nine or fewer sites would move forward for a marine reserve designation. These sites had to be ecologically meaningful while avoiding social and economic hardship. And any proposals that came forward to OPAC that had stakeholder collaboration on various sides, those sites would be rewarded. So these are the 20 proposals that were submitted to OPAC spanning the entirety of the coast. So 20 were proposed. There was an agency analysis by the various ocean agencies, and OPAC made these recommendations. So there would be an area for a new proposal. So the proposals that were submitted were thrown out, and the International Port of Coos Bay came forward to help develop a new proposal in that general area. The most developed sites were the pilot sites. These were the most mature, had the most level of collaboration, and these two sites would move forward for further implementation. And then there was areas for further evaluation. These proposals needed to be studied and evaluated further. So that led us through 2008 and into the 2009 legislative session, where we got the Marine Reserves Bill, House Bill 3013, which was sponsored by the Oregon Coastal Caucus. And what the bill said was, you shall implement the OPAC recommendations on these three different types of sites. The proposal site, again, working with ODF&W to develop a new proposal, the pilot sites to study, monitor, evaluate, and enforce, and to study and evaluate these future evaluation sites. The bill also required the development of a marine reserve work plan that would set the sideboards for the process, involve the public and scientists, and gave a template for how we would move forward as an agency. The bill also allocated $1 million from the running aground of the new Carissa, so this was a one-time funding source, and also gave us leniency to receive other funds that were consistent with our work plan, and then it asked us to report back to the legislator on or before November 30th, which is why we are here today. So very quickly, the proposal site is a large swath of area around the Coos Bay area, and so this process is being led by the International Port of Coos Bay. They have outlined their process, and they are seeing if there is any region within this general area that can be moved forward as a new proposal. Again, the pilot sites, these are the most developed sites. Otter Rock, just north of Newport, and Redfish Rocks is south of Port Orford. These pilot sites have already gone through their rulemaking process through our three agencies, DSL, Parks, and ODF&W, so rules have been created, though prohibitions don't go into effect until next summer. These sites already had a community teams associated with them. However, both these sites chose to expand upon their community teams either through working groups or new membership to gain a little bit more diversity. These sites have also developed management plans, so these community teams work very closely with ODFNW on the socioeconomic, biological enforcement, and outreach components of their management plans, and they're starting to collect baseline studies before the prohibitions go into effect.
And will you tell us who we're looking at on that in that picture?
So,
I assume that's one of the community teams?
Yeah, so that's the Redfish Rock community team. The back area is the community team's members themselves, and then the front row are ODFNW employees and Sea Grant.
Great.
So... and then just briefly, kind of the baseline studies that we're doing, because it's pretty interesting, I think. Ecologically speaking, we're doing oceanographic baseline studies, so we have moorings out at each of the sites. And we're also doing habitat and species information and collection, so using ROVs, scuba diving, video landers, and then also using the seafloor mapping that we received money for last legislative session to give us more information on habitat. And also, one of the key components of these sites and baseline studies is doing cooperative research. We're employing our local fishing fleets to be the ones that take us out to do video lander studies and to make sure that they're engaged in this process as well. Socioeconomically speaking, the baseline studies include a rapid assessment, so looking at logbooks and getting a picture of these sites before prohibitions go into effect. We're also looking at them from a regional scale. And then looking at the ecosystem services that are provided, water quality, runoff, buffering systems, things like that. Developing an economic model to assess change over time and giving a picture of these fishing communities over time as well with the fishing community profiles. And the rest of my talk, I'll focus mostly on the evaluation sites. These sites will see the most change in the next few months, and just wanted to briefly update on that as well. So as outlined in House Bill 3013, there was a development of community teams with 8 different stakeholder groups. They have diverse and balanced representation. We have 32 members on each of these community teams. So that's 3 community teams, 32 members each. They meet for 1 to 2 meetings a month for 3 to 4 hours. It's a lot of community time, a lot of engagement, and a lot of commitment to this process. It's over 4,000 stakeholder hours just in the 9 months that we've been doing community teams so far with evaluation sites. So what they've been charged to do is starting with the OPAC boundaries. Again, these proposals were developed and given to OPAC, so they're starting with those proposals, and they're looking at are they individually, collectively large enough to allow scientific evaluation of the benefits, but really weighing are they too big or can they become smaller to avoid that social and economic impact. And that's really, they're really going through this balancing act of finding a site that is appropriate for all the user groups. And their decisions or their recommendations will be made through a consensus-building process by the end of October or early November. And if consensus cannot be reached, a vote and a minority report will be provided. So what they've been doing so far at all their meetings is familiarizing themselves with the site, each other, and the process so far. They've been doing an extensive amount of information gathering through the data that we've been able to provide them. And then local knowledge. These people live in this area. They fish in this area. They have the knowledge about the site, sometimes even more so than what the agencies can provide. So they've been really earnest about sharing that information and getting to know the site. And then we've been able to provide them with new data with surveys and habitat maps and things like that. So what they've been doing with that new knowledge is they develop new scenarios, modifying the boundaries that will allow them to gain more information on the site. These are not the recommendations, but just scenarios of what ifs, if we modify the OPAC boundaries, what would happen to the ecological site and the socioeconomics. So this is just an example of kind of the conversations that are happening on how to modify the OPAC boundaries. So this is the Cascade Head. The OPAC boundaries are in red. This is a habitat map provided by the Goldfinger Lab. So socioeconomically speaking, this is the Salmon River. There's a small fishing community that comes out of here in the mouth of the salmon. They fish for crab and salmon. So that's a social concern that the teams are considering. How do they modify that boundary to potentially eliminate or reduce that type of impact? In the western edge, there's sandy bottom habitat, which is prime fishing crab ground. So can they modify the boundary as well to minimize that type of impact? And then ecologically speaking, you see the tip of the Celeste Reef there, which is a key habitat in this region. Is there enough habitat represented to have an ecologically meaningful site? through this process, we've had a lot of public input. Through every single meeting, there's a public input opportunity. We have a website that has a bulletin board where public can submit comments for the teams to read. And then also we have public comment period that is currently open right now for people to provide input on the scenarios that were developed by the teams. We'll conduct an agency analysis, or have conducted an agency analysis, working with various state agencies. And we've also gone to the Science and Technical Advisory Committee of OPAC to provide input on our analysis as well. So for the future of these teams, they will make their final recommendations, like I said, in a few, hopefully in a month. We'll go back to the Science and Technical Advisory Committee to make sure that these sites are scientifically valid. We'll have another public comment period. We'll consult with OPAC and then return to the legislature. Similarly, with the proposal sites, potentially there will be a recommendation. The pilot sites prohibitions will go into effect in the summer, so we'll have another season of baseline studies and then enforcement and monitoring over time. There will always be a continuation of the community teams and public engagement through this process. There's been a lot of time and energy invested by stakeholders in the communities, and we want to see that they are able to engage throughout this whole process. And then we'll look at different funding scenarios, hopefully a diverse portfolio from federal, state, and private funds. And with that, well, you can answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
I just have a comment. I just want to thank ODFNW for your most thorough and patient application of all these things that Anna just outlined for us. And I can't say enough. I get some emails from people who are at this point just now finding out about something. And even at some levels, there's some disinformation, but they've been able to get the right information out to people, and between myself and Senator Johnson and others in our area, and I have two sites in my district, and as does Senator Johnson, and so we've been able to meet with people, actually go out on site on some of these, and alleviate some fears that some of the people have had when they heard rumors that just flat weren't true. But the process, going through the meetings, I've sat in on a couple of them. I can't go to all of them, but they're long meetings, a lot of people giving a lot of time, and they don't have to go, but these guys have to go. And Anna has been just a real trooper. Thank you so much for all you've done. And Ed, thank you for putting this all together.
It certainly was a smart hire to get Anna, who worked on this issue so well and so hard as a Sea Grant Fellow, right, and with the Coastal Caucus.
She shepherded the legislation through, so there was really not a better person to do this who had the full knowledge of it. And she's pretty tough young woman, so thank you.
Any questions or comments from other members of the committee? Well, great. Appreciate the update and look forward to hearing about continued progress. So, thank you. Thank you. We will move next to Representative Roblin and Steve Brandt to hear about another bill that this committee spent a bit of time with in the last session, establishing the Nearshore Research Task Force. And Representative Roblin, you were instrumental in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Arnie Roblin, representative from District 9. This has been kind of one of my passions since my first introduction to the legislature three terms ago. The idea that comes up every time we have a conversation about ocean reserves or any other kinds of use of our ocean has always been, well, we just don't have the research. And we make the complaint that we don't have the research, but we've never funded research, so that's why we don't have the research. And I am a firm believer that the best way to make decisions is to get the facts as best we can and then use those facts to help make good policy decisions from committees like this one. And so the previous session, I had a long conversation about a bill that I was looking at introducing and eventually realized that it was not going to move because we had come to the conclusion that any one person trying to figure out what it should look like was not going to meet the needs of all the other stakeholders, just like we did with the Marine Reserves. And so in the very last session, we made the decision, a number of people, including some scientists, made the decision that what we really needed to do is put together a committee of concerned groups of people who could look at the whole issue of marine research on the Oregon coast and come back with recommendations to this body about how to go about organizing that. And I want to say that from the very first meeting, which I got to go to, this was an amazing group of people who represented as many interest groups as we could. And in the bill, it was pretty specific about who those people were. And in that first meeting, they had an election and came to the conclusion that Dr. Brand next to me would be the person in charge, would be the director of this herding of cats that were all these people, to try to come up with some recommendations to us. And it was fraught with the same kinds of things that Ocean Reserves were. There were explosions amongst different people, especially Coastal Caucus members, about which direction it was going here or there, and different people on that committee had different ideas about which way it should go, and there was pushing and shoving. And through it all, Dr. Brandt kept his collective calm and kept bringing it back to the group of people who represented those different interest groups, the idea that we have a mission, and it's a really important one, and that is to come up with a consensus group of recommendations for the next legislature to look at that will help Oregon in the future use and get research to make decisions about this very, very important resource we have, that 3-mile strip on the Oregon coast. And I was very, very pleased and in awe, actually, of the ability of Dr. Brandt to step back and not take personal all the different arrows that were thrown his way from a lot of different groups, and to continue to focus back at what is our mission and how are we going to do that and what recommendations, and to come up with a consensus group of recommendations that, from my perspective, are rather impressive. And I hope that as a committee, as others, we will look at those recommendations and decide what kind of things can we move forward with in this next session to help us have what I would say would be a singular group of proposals. And I'll let Dr. Brandt talk about those. But for me, it's the idea that we will have a scientific group of people who we can trust that the information they're going to give us is the best information that we could possibly get and help us make decisions, and a group that we can ask questions of to get information back and who can make the decisions about what are the most important pieces of information we need to gather over the next few years. And secondly, an organization that can receive and take funds from lots of different sources and then take those funds and appropriately use those to find answers that this scientific group independently has decided those are the things we need to find answers for. So with that, I will let Dr. Brandt talk a little bit more about the whole process and some of the recommendations. But it was amazing for me to watch that process in a short period of time. The quality of information that came from research all over this country about organizations that were similar to the one we're looking at doing here is pretty impressive, and I know that you don't have time to look at all of that, but I will tell you that they used the resources that they had, and it wasn't that much, to do an awful lot of work looking nationally and internationally for kinds of programs that we could emulate, and I think they've come up with a plan that, from my perspective, is one that we need to support. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Brandt.
Thank you, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me here. For the record, I'm Stephen Brandt. I'm a professor at Oregon State University and director of the Oregon Sea Grant Program. And as Representative Roebling said, I'm here today as the elected chair of the task force. I want to thank Representative Roebling for the kind words. It really wasn't all that bad. In fact, I actually had fun on most occasions during the process. You have in front of you the written text of, in my written testimony, the full report that we submitted on August 1st. And what I would like to do today is just go over briefly and highlight some of the operations and how we worked, and highlight some of the key recommendations we've made in that in the task force. As Representative Roebling said, we had a very, very distinguished group of folks as members of the task force. There were 7 members that represented both agencies and institutions. and then another seven members that represented various interest groups. And this was a very dynamic group, and many of you probably know many of these folks, and it was very interesting, and I think it was an honor for me to work with these individuals, because I think at heart all of them wanted to do something that would be valuable for the state and valuable for achieving the mission that we had assigned to us by House Bill 3106. Our overall rationale of the bill itself was to recognize that it's important to foster an environment where trusted scientific information can be informed both policy and management. One of the key our recommendations are designed to therefore strengthen the state's ability to do two fundamental things. One is to obtain that unbiased scientific advice, the scientific advice that people can have confidence in and will trust. That's probably as important as getting the advice, that people to really truly believe that that's coming from a well-trusted source. And secondly, the ability to prioritize and coordinate research and monitoring. There's a lot of research and monitoring that goes on, but particularly in these times of hard economic funding, I guess, and also the need for specific information and the need for important information, that science needs to be prioritized and coordinated to make the best use of the money. Our report also provides a number of checks and balances with extensive public processes throughout. Our operations were to work by consensus, and all of our decisions were made by consensus. I can say of the six recommendations, we did vote on the recommendations, and all of them were unanimously supported by all 14 members, with one exception, one abstention, and one recommendation. So we largely had full unanimity on the final recommendations. We took the process that rather than create a number of new entities to, given the tight financial circumstances, to try and use existing entities and structures where possible and modify those in a way that might make them more effective. And again, we did have public, all of our meetings were public, and we had public meetings as well as a website. We elected a chair. We were originally formed in December. Between December and our August 1st deadline, we had eight 1 to 2 day meetings. We brought in a number of guest speakers, panelists, facilitations. We had contractual services to do specific reports for us. We developed a number of draft documents that we circulated to various folks. I gave presentations to OPAC as well as to the Coastal Caucus at some time into that process. We listened to their input, modified our recommendations, and so forth, and the final recommendations were submitted on August 1st. I'll go through some of the core recommendations now. One of the key overarching recommendations is to develop a multi-year nearshore strategic plan. There are a number of guiding documents that were given to us in the bill that where the state has set some priorities, the territorial sea plan and so forth. There's also some regional activities such as the West Coast Governor's Agreement that have some priorities in it, but the state does not have a multi-year strategic plan from which one could derive research and monitoring priorities. Some of the other rationale is that for having a strategic plan is, again, that one, we can set the priorities, we can make better use of the money that we have to target towards those particular goals, but we can also leverage our activities and leverage our priorities to both regional and federal funding opportunities. If we are in the lead and have a strategic plan out in front of other things going on, we can take a leadership role not only within the state, of course, but also on a regional and perhaps national level, rather than being responsive to those kinds of outside pressures. To put this in perspective, if we had a strategic plan, and I just drew these up last night to try and provide, because people like bubble diagrams, and we keep hearing from when I make presentations that we need to have bubble diagrams. So here's a bubble diagram. The strategic plan is to be... the way one builds a strategic plan is having input not only from the policy and OPAC, but from STAC, the scientific community, the public, and by that I mean the broader stakeholder community, as well as the decision makers. And that provides overall long-term guidance back to those policy makers, to the public, to decision makers, and frankly to the science as well. So it's a two-way street to develop that and then use that as strategic guidance. In order to develop that strategic plan, we recommended to develop what we're calling a work group. The work group would largely have two responsibilities. One is to make sure that the strategic plan is actually developed, and secondly, that once developed, that it's actually implemented through the state agencies and other areas. Another core recommendation is to take the Scientific and Technology Advisory Committee, STAC, that you've heard about, and make it a fully independent advisory body that is advisory at all levels. And let me explain what I mean by that. Most of you probably know that currently STAC, and originally STAC, was developed to provide advice to OPAC, Ocean Policy Advisory Council. The House Bill 3013 provided additional responsibility to STAC to specifically advise ODF&W on marine reserves. But that required separate legislation to authorize STAC to do that. What we're proposing is that STAC would be given further authorization to largely be able to advise all state decision makers, both the legislation, the governor's office, all various state agencies, and so forth. It becomes a truly sort of an independent body to provide that scientific, trusted information. To do that, we would need to broaden the number of members of STAC. We propose doing so with regard following the procedures in the National Academy of Sciences, which is the federal science advisory body for both the House, for both the legislation and executive branch. That it, and then STAC would help develop the regional monitoring priorities for the state, as well as advise a number of different entities. One way to look at this, then, is consider the Oregon state decision makers. They would get the policy advice would continue from OPAC. They would have the ability to get scientific advice from STAC, and then have strategic guidance through the development of this strategic plan. There were three other core recommendations. One was to ensure that citizens and communities are fully involved in the processes of the recommendations. The second is to establish a coordinated data management system under the Oregon Coastal Management Program. And the third, and perhaps most controversial at this stage, is to create a science trust as a standalone nonprofit 501c3. I'll go into a little bit of the rationale. They're fairly well explained in the written report. Clearly, the rationale for community engagement is well known and well respected. Individuals are a wealth of knowledge and expertise, and ensuring the community participation in the nearshore planning will be essential for their continued support. The data management, there's a number of reasons to have data management. Probably the one that's most reasonable is that it really, in the long run, will reduce our ability or reduce the overlap in activities, reduce any duplication of effort, and frankly provide a better, rich source of information so that decision-making can be better informed. The Science Trust, the mission of the Science Trust is to provide a mechanism to help other funders to implement the strategic plan. If there's either private or public entities that want to fund research in the state, they can certainly do that now, but they can do it and do it to fund things they want to fund. By funding it through a trust that adheres to the Oregon strategic plan, it funnels the money in a way that is used towards areas that are recognized by the state as key priorities. I think that's the summary. This is a summary of the six core recommendations, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This scientific analysis piece is hugely interesting to me because of the concern by all of the inherent bias in whatever the outcome might be. So what's the best way of saying to folks, you can forget about bias, there just isn't any in this report, and to actually keep a straight face. It's difficult because in all the things I see, whether it's right now we have a sage-grouse thing happening across the state, whether we have a bull trout study, or whether we have a water temperature study, or whatever we have, the science is always portrayed as being without bias, but it's hard to believe that. So what do you do? Do you have 15 different groups come in and comment on the first study? Or what's the best way to get around this inherent difficulty of, I think you addressed it right off the top, no confidence in the science. So what do you do to attack that that common belief?
In the scientific world, there's a very rigorous process called peer review. And that is the accepted, it's been accepted for 100 years as the way to determine whether the science is valid or not. The peer review process means that you take scientists that have expertise in that area and they review the product and decide whether or not it's good science or not. That's done in the context of publications. There are a wide variety of publications. Some are just, just web publications. Some are published to the scientific literature in a peer-reviewed journal. It means that that article has been looked at by experts in the field who have independent experts in the field who have evaluated that work and said that this work is valid, the methods are valid, the results and conclusions drawn from the results are valid. So that peer review process is fairly well established, and it can be done by panels, it can be done by individual outside mail reviews. There's various ways that are well accepted to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems that in order for that approach to make to work, one has to understand the nature of the initial query, and one has to understand the nature of the people called in to do the initial study and the nature of the people called in to do the peer review. And without having an understanding of each of those elements or those parts of the process, the competence piece is still questionable. So is it safe to say that each one of these outcomes is going to be subject to challenge at some level, and all we're really doing is maybe reducing the possibility of that challenge?
I think, realistically, some people will always mistrust science, but I think from if you set up a process that is rigorous, and I think a good example would be that evaluating a proposal. This is something that Sea Grant does all the time. It's done in the National Science Foundation. It's very well received. You look at one of the things you look at. First of all, you have a third party who picks out the expert scientists. So I don't ask somebody else to review my work. And there's a third party who gets the experts to review the work. They're knowledgeable enough to know, the reviewers are knowledgeable enough to know the background, perhaps, of the area, certainly the background of the science. In a proposal process, you also evaluate the background of the individuals who have done the work. You see copies of their resumes and their publications, their qualifications to do the work. Then you see what they propose to do, you see how well they've done it, and you see the conclusions that they've drawn from that. It is a very rigorous process, and I think that I think the difficulty lies now is that oftentimes one will see a piece of work that has been well peer-reviewed, and someone else will put up another piece of work that has not been, and unless they're looking at it from that perspective, it's very difficult to say which one is better. You need to really have that process set up. So that's why in the case what we're talking about is if you have STAC set up to review a field of science, to review a particular body of work, then they would be the trusted body who would use peer review, standard rigorous peer review processes to say whether or not that work is valid. It takes time and it takes a building of trust.
Representative Roblin, you want to jump in here and then to Representative
Also, part of the discussion was in the actual process of doing an RFP, where you a referral for a particular project, the conversations that took place there, and this doesn't get into the details of that, but the understanding would be that STAC would have, or this other group would have money, and they would go out, they want to know something about a particular fish or whatever. We anticipate that in making those rules, both the question that's being asked and all of the data that led to the conclusion will be public information through STAC and available to any other scientist to look at, regardless of whether they're in the peer review or not. It's going to be part of the record so that it can be replicable. Other people can go out and try to do the same thing and see if they get the same results. And it will all be transparent. And that conversation took place in this committee on a number of cases because getting to that point where you really trust the science, the answer is every time you do an experiment, you do the experiment given the conditions you have. And conditions can change, other things can happen. The issue is how do we get science that then it doesn't tell what you're going to do with that science. It only says, here's the best that we have available, here's how we got it, and here you go, policymakers. Use it as you wish with respect to making decisions about how you want to function with the ocean. I think the National Academy of Sciences does that really well. Anybody can ask them questions. They'll go out and get the research and find the people and do the stuff and then give you the information. It's yours to use however you wish to use it. And I think that's what this group came to the conclusion is that's the kind of organization we want to have available to us. We don't want a group who wants to contribute money. They would give it to this 501c3. They would decide how it's going to be spent completely. They would decide the questions that are going to be asked and how it works with our strategic plan. That keeps the funding sources away from the people who are actually going to do the research. And it makes sure that the research is something that every one of us can look at or ask our own experts to look it over and say, can you find anything in here that is a problem? I think that's the only way we start getting back personally to having a trust in the information that we're being given. And I think they did a good job of making that clear in this report.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along this line, I think the need for rigorous science speaks to the need for funding, and that having a good process requires an investment in order to have confidence in the results. And I'm interested to know more in your report about where you see opportunities for ongoing funding streams. I think it's incredibly important that we demonstrate value to the communities that have supported this research by delivering back that high-quality data and information in order to best inform management decisions in the coast and in marine reserves as well. I would be interested to know at some point whether or not, because the Oregon coast is a park, whether or not we might be able to investigate the use of lottery dollars under parks funding for research in marine reserves and other areas of the coast.
I'll just say I think we need to look at any and all possibilities for that. I think once there's, in my opinion, I look at some things that happen in New Zealand around their research and their reserves and things. Other people came to do that because they saw a process that could be clear of all those, as clear as possible from those biases, because I agree with you. Any person who says they don't have a bias hasn't looked at themselves close enough. So, I mean, it is a reality that we have a bias when we go in. The question is, good science tries to take those out. They try to acknowledge that they exist and then remove them from the conversation. If a good process is set up, like the one I believe is being recommended to you today, I think there are other outside funders who would say that's the kind of things that we want to support, and they would support it. I also believe that the state's going to have to come in and be a part of that, and I think there's other lottery funding that may be a possibility. But in the final analysis, we as Oregonians have to decide, is this resource important enough for us to invest in to find out what we really have there? And I think we've put things together to do that, but over time, it's getting the system set up appropriately. I believe if you do that, it's kind of like the old book, the movie, if you build it, they'll come, the baseball film. I think that if you get a process that from everybody outside says that's the kind of process we want to entrust in, I think that those other things can and will flow. And as we have to make more and more decisions in the state, I think we're going to want more and more information on how to wisely spend the few dollars we have.
If I can add to that a little bit, there are also federal funding opportunities, and oftentimes when you look at what the federal one of the criteria for federal funding oftentimes is, does this meet a state priority? And if one has a list of clearly identified state priorities in something like a strategic plan, that provides leverage for those individuals seeking federal funds to apply it towards that, and frankly make their work much more useful.
That's an important point.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the update on the work and look forward to more. Representative Roblin, I think you had a hand in the Aquatic Species Task Force as well. We're about to hear from the department their presentation on the report, another task force report owed to us. So we'll get that from the department. I don't know if you have any.
I'll probably say it was an impressive opportunity to listen. Invasive species has been an issue of mine since also I got here in a number of different ways. Aquatic species are of keen interest because I live on an estuary in a bay and a lot of issues happen there. We know what's happened to the San Francisco Harbor, and we don't want that to happen to our rivers and streams with respect to the number of different varieties of international organisms that now live there. We have to be careful, and we have to figure out ways in which we can do that. And I think this task force was one that was really important for me. I felt really honored to be a part of it. So I just look forward to you hearing the recommendations from that one as well.
Super. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brandt. So we'll invite Ryan Hoof from the department.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bernhardt.
While they're coming up, I simply wanted to add to the discussion we were just having. I particularly like the answer that Representative Roblin gave to the questions that very appropriate questions that Representative Bentz and Representative Bailey were talking about. You know, scientific research is a little bit like democracy. We set up a process, we set up safeguards, we set up systems to try to get to good results, and to try to get to results that we can use in ways that will help guide the people and government agencies and everybody else. And they only work as well as the people who run them, and as well as the level of humility that people have as they pursue the outcomes that they're working on. I particularly like the idea that the way to do this is with transparency, with a clear statement of the question you're trying to deal with the openness to peer review, with a willingness to reevaluate your own conclusions as well as look at other people's, and the kind of messy process that goes into the kind of long-term evaluation of all of these issues that we're working with. I mean, democracy and scientific inquiry aren't quite the same thing, but we're never going to get rid of the messiness or the ambiguity in either process. And I think acknowledging that fact and accepting the reality that we always have to be willing to examine our assumptions, we always have to be willing to look at what the other guy says and evaluate that. And it isn't always the weight of opinion that is true. And so these are complex issues, and I really appreciate, Representative, your response in connection with that, because I think that's exactly right on.
It strikes me that this committee is the perfect one to hold a colloquium on the question of objectivity in science. I think we could spend several hours at that and we'd invite Representative Roblin as well. And indeed, a fascinating topic, and well put yourself, Representative Bernhardt. Let's hear about the science, objective, I'm sure, on shipping transport of aquatic invasive species.
Great. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. We're really pleased to be here today to talk to you about the work of the Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force, which was created by the 2007 legislature. And Representative Roblin, I don't know if he's behind me or not, but if he's not, I certainly want to acknowledge him and other legislators that have participated in being forward-thinking in terms of something that's of critical concern, I think, for Oregonians and Oregon's waterways. And following up on what Representative Bernhardt said, I do believe that some of these decisions are incredibly complex, ripe for all kinds of discussion, and all the task force and information that's been created is absolutely necessary if we're to help you make informed decisions. And I think this is one of those areas that will benefit from that, hopefully. And invasive species are a big issue for Oregon, and aquatic invasive species as well. The good news is that Oregon is not as impacted as some of the other coastal states around us, up in Puget Sound, starting to get some problems, serious problems with invasive species. And Representative Roblin pointed out, but down to our south, San Francisco is an absolute mess, San Francisco Bay. We do not want that in Oregon. And I think what you tasked us to do was to really, with this task force, is work with them to see the import of this program and how we're going to move forward with it to be ahead of the curve, if you will, and do what we can to prevent invasive species from impacting our waterways the way it is starting to up to the north and has to the south. So with that, I'd like to introduce Ryan Hoof. He's our ballast water program coordinator at DEQ, and certainly one of the heavier lifters on this topic, important topic. So, and Ryan will give you an update on where we're at.
Thank you. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Hoof, Ballast Water Program Coordinator, DEQ, and I'm here today also on behalf of the Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force. Due to a scheduling conflict, the chair of the task force, Mark Sitzma from Portland State University, was unfortunately unable to attend. But he did ask that I present a letter on his behalf, which is the second page of the handouts that I've provided to you today. In the interest of time, I won't read that letter verbatim, but just want to reiterate that the task force recognizes that this upcoming session will present a variety of challenges, but that they ask for your thoughtful consideration of the findings and recommendations of the report that I'll be summarizing for you here this morning. The third page of that handout that I've also provided includes general overview fact sheets of both the task force itself, listing membership and background, and also the other side of that sheet is the fact sheet regarding the ballast water program itself at DEQ. The Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force is charged with studying and making recommendations for preventing the introduction of aquatic invasive species from commercial shipping transport activities. That includes ballast water discharge, but also biofouling or hole fouling, the types of critters that can attach to hard surfaces and be transported via that pathway. The director of DEQ has appointed members to the task force in order to achieve an equitable representation from the maritime industry, as well as the environmental and academic research communities, as well as representation from relevant federal and state agencies. In addition, the legislative leadership is responsible for appointing four legislative advisors to the task force, which in 2010 included Senators Cruz and Verger, as well as Representative Roblin and Representative Witt. In 2009, House Bill 2714, which became law, specifically defined the objectives of the task force to include identifying and recommending sources of funding to support and maintain the ballast water program at DEQ, established by Oregon Statute 783.620. Between October of 2009 and May of 2010, the task force met seven times, and the agenda of those meetings was largely dominated this past year by the goal of addressing funding limitations and challenges faced by DEQ's ballast water program, which is currently supported by general fund at the level of one FTE for statewide for a variety of program responsibilities and activities that includes vessel monitoring and report screening, that's pre-arrival report screening, vessel inspections and compliance verification sampling, policy development, and that includes working with neighboring states and other jurisdictions, as well as outreach and technical support services in consultation with the maritime industry. The task force report, which was completed in June, reviewed regulations in other jurisdictions, it analyzed shipping and ballast water management trends from data that's collected by DEQ, and it also discussed various emerging issues and legal uncertainties that continue to complicate and create a dynamic policy landscape. An electronic version of the report is available on DEQ's website, but I've also brought some highly abridged hard copies, which I'd be happy to provide to committee members, that includes the executive summary as well as the section detailing the legislative recommendations. I've chosen not to present extensive amounts of the data that are in the report that really support the importance of ballast water management regulatory oversight at the state or local level. But instead, I'd like to focus on the task force recommendations, which really came in two forms. There's two general recommendations, but also one set of specific recommendations concerning ballast water program resources and budgeting solutions, which I'll get to in just a moment. First of all, the task force supports efforts by the legislature that may increase state resources that would be available for use in the event of invasive species early detection and the subsequent rapid response that could be followed up that might help in eradication or limiting the economic or environmental damages from such a detection. That could come in two forms, or at least suggested in two forms by the task force. One is to appropriately fund the Oregon Invasive Species Council Control Fund that was established by the 2009 legislature. Second recommendation along those lines is to pursue a legislative resolution to the U.S. Congress in support of Senate Bill 3063, which would provide financial support to western states to manage new introductions of invasive species. A second general recommendation is simply to remove the sunset date or extend the sunset date and provide for continuation of the task force so that it can continue to further study and assess aquatic invasive species prevention strategies and policy developments. With regards to budgeting solutions and levels of resources for the ballast water program here in Oregon, the task force recommends that the legislature establish a new fee. It would be for the commercial vessels that are regulated by our Ballast Water Management Act that would, in effect, provide a sufficient amount of support for a 50-50 cost share between public and private sources. This cost share arrangement is really aimed at preventing further invasive species introductions into our state and would support the program administration expenses at DEQ. Also, the task force recommends that with that revenue, that the legislature authorize DEQ to hire one more half FTE, 0.5 FTE, as well as provide supplemental funds that have been requested in past legislative sessions to support program goals and services at DEQ. In effect, these increased resources would allow for a significant increase in the rate of vessel boarding and compliance verification sampling by DEQ staff. Currently, we are boarding about 3.5% of vessel arrivals coming into Oregon ports. It is projected that with the additional half FTE, we would increase that rate of inspection to at least 12% of arrivals coming into Oregon ports. In addition, it would provide for at least a 10% increase in DEQ staff coverage for daily monitoring of vessel arrivals and the screening of the pre-arrival ballast water reports. This coverage is critical as a prevention strategy. It's also important to industry in that it can be extremely costly to vessel operators if non-compliant discharge is detected somewhere along the lines of key economic trigger points once they've gone dockside, for example, if they then have to leave to conduct the proper management strategies offshore. It's very, very expensive, and so having DEQ staff coverage is something that industry largely supports to help alleviate those types of complications. And lastly, the necessary supplemental funds, or the requested supplemental funds, would support a variety of program activities, including purchasing industry data about ship traffic and vessel owner information. It would provide for field equipment and laboratory charges for testing ballast water samples, and also could provide for fees that would be associated with administering and billing for this new fee program, because we propose to do that in a fashion similar to the oil spill prevention fee, which is administered by a third-party industry group. In general, the task force works to strives towards consensus decision making, representing the agreement of all the members. But there was one dissenting opinion regarding the fee proposal and budget solution. And eventually, the chair of the task force chose to take a vote, which revealed that all task force members, including three of the four maritime industry representatives, were in support of the proposals, as I've outlined here today. The one task force member that did not support the proposal was the member representing the Western States Petroleum Association. The membership of that association generally opposed any fee or additional resources for this program. I'd also like to note, with regards to the process and development of these final recommendations, that the task force carefully scrutinized ballast water program activities and operations to re-examine the program goals and to seek any opportunities for increased efficiencies that they could have or that we could have. They also explored various options for other potential revenue sources before they adopted the idea of a vessel arrival fee. And they also, in light of the vessel fee proposal, discussed a variety of mechanisms that would be the fairest or most economically sensitive way to implement a new fee. We talk about a range of things, including a sliding scale based upon those vessels that are that represent the highest risk for transporting invasive species. They talked about a multi-tiered fee structure, but in the end, a flat fee, $70 per arrival fee, or I should say $68 to $70 is what the task force noted, fee is what they felt like was most reasonable and easiest to implement. And again, I just want to reiterate that a substantial amount of the industry support for this was in recognition that there's support for and the modeling of the DEQ oil spill prevention program, and the way that has worked out has been very efficient to the liking of industry. Currently in development and in under review by the governor's office are two pending opportunities that the 2000 legislature may be able to act upon in order to support these task force recommendations. First is legislative concept 845, which would implement the $70 fee for vessels regulated under the Ballast Water Act beginning in January of 2012. DEQ estimates the fee would generate approximately $210,000 per biennium in revenue, assuming 1,500 ship arrivals per year. And the revenue collected would be deposited into a newly created ballast water fund, and funds would be continuously appropriated to DEQ, specifically for ballast water management regulation implementation. Second component of the recommendations is a DEQ policy option package 134, which would authorize DEQ to hire the additional half FTE, as well as the allocate the additional supplemental funds that I noted. In particular, the position would facilitate increased vessel inspection rates, as I noted as well. As proposed, the legislative concept and policy option package together would allow for a modest increase in program resources to accomplish our goals of invasive species prevention, while also simultaneously reducing the program reliance on general fund. And in fact, the net result would be a reduction in general fund dollars allocated to support this program at DEQ. On behalf of the task force and DEQ, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present the summary of the 2010 report. The findings and recommendations reflect the hard work and careful deliberations of the task force, and if implemented, would greatly benefit our efforts to protect Oregon waterways and coastal ecosystems from aquatic invasive species. At this point in time, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thanks for that report, Representative Jensen. It sounds like maybe a subject for the Ways and Means Subcommittee as well, coming out of this, these recommendations, and look forward to working with that committee on this issue. Thanks. Seeing no questions, I'll excuse you. Thank you, committee members. We'll close this interim meeting of the House Environment and Water Committee.